Okay, it's December 20th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm talking with Johnny Lott. And Mr. Lott, I was hoping you could start with some of your personal and educational background, what brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana.
Okay. I grew up in Tennessee, in West Tennessee. I went to a small high school, 400 students, roughly, grades 7 through 12. A little community where I grew up before that. Had five teachers for eight grades, so it was actually big compared to many of Montana's schools. But upon graduating from high school, and this is growing up in a rural area, neither of my parents had gone to college. And so I was the first to go to college. And I got scholarships and went to Union University, a small Baptist school in Jackson, Tennessee, and majored in math. When I went there, I had no idea what I was going to do. It was one of those things where I was only 16 when I graduated from high school, and I wasn't old enough to get a real job. So going to college seemed like the best thing that I could do at that stage. I knew I was going to major in math because it was the only thing that I really liked, and I thought I might be an engineer for a month or two, but that didn't last long, and I wound up teaching in math for a variety of reasons, and not the least of which was the Vietnam War, because people who were teaching math and science got legal deferments, and so I became a high school math teacher. On graduation from Union, I moved immediately to Atlanta and started teaching in the DeKalb County Public Schools, Lakeside High School. And at the same time while I was there, this was during the New Math Movement. And so it's kind of my first introduction to curriculum in the high school, which is wound up being a lifelong interest and goal. I found out that I didn't know some of the topics that they were teaching in high school. So my department chair encouraged me to go to Emory University and finish a master's, which I did in about 1969, I guess. And from there, I went to a college prep high school in Atlanta, but I only stayed there for 1 year because staying there 1 year, I knew that that wasn't the right school for me to be in and didn't know what I wanted to do. So I went back to graduate school and started working on a doctorate. And I finished a doctorate in math ed at Georgia State. Georgia State hired me as a half-time instructor while I was working on that degree. And when I finished that, I stayed one more year there where they hired me as a full instructor. Again, trying to give me time to figure out what I wanted to do. I started job looking, and I wound up going to Atlantic City, New Jersey, where I saw a little 3x5 card stuck on a bulletin board that said visiting appointment at the University of Montana. And I called the number that was there, went over to the hotel room, and met Rick Bilstein, who's still a faculty member here today, and Shlomo Liebeskind, who's now at the University of Oregon. And I went over and interviewed with them. I had no idea where Missoula, Montana was. Truthfully, I hardly knew where Montana was. It was up there somewhere. And I went back to Atlanta, and my wife, Carol, and I laughed about it because there's no way we would move to Montana. And then they called and offered the job. And we looked at each other for a few minutes and said, sure, why not? Georgia State had offered me a job, and I could have stayed there, but I felt like I was going to be a student if I stayed there because I just graduated from there. So we packed up some of our stuff, left most what little furniture we had in storage. So the two of us and our year-old son moved out here. And we spent 1 year living in Bill Ballard's house, who was a faculty member in mathematics and on leave. During that year, I found some more jobs, none of which I liked. And Shlomo, who was on leave from here, whose job I had while he was in Israel, wanted another year's leave. So they offered me the job again. And we said, okay, let's stay another year. And we bought a house with a guarantee from one of the local real estate agents that she would buy it back if at the end of the year we needed to sell it. So we moved on Ronald, about 3 or 4 blocks from campus here. And during that year, the math department asked someone to resign. We had a faculty member who was not showing up to teach classes. And the president had the department giving many opportunities. And after the last opportunity to stay and start showing up on time, he didn't show up to teach the next day. So they asked him to resign, and he did. And the department offered me his job. So that was the beginning of a pretty happy relationship here. I came to stay 9 months and stayed 32 and a half years. So
what year was that when you first...
I came here in 1974.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go back. You mentioned that when you were first teaching, you were introduced to the new math movement that had to do with curriculum that you weren't familiar with. Can you briefly describe what the new math movement was or is? Is it still around?
Well, in a sense, it's still around. Mm-hmm. So I'll hedge this question in lots of ways. One of the things that had happened with Sputniks going up in roughly 1957, I think, the National Science Foundation was founded, and it started encouraging development of curriculum in high schools and grade schools. Much of that curriculum was developed by mathematicians. And the truth of the matter is, books were published, put in print, and given to schools without very much training for teachers. And teachers were kind of at a loss. And I have to admit, I was a fairly decent student as an undergraduate, but I got out there and they were using terms and language and math that I truly didn't know, because I'd been in a very traditional, small college program. And this movement was talking about sets, it was talking about subsets, all of which are common now, okay? And it might have been common in some circles then, but it wasn't common in the school that I had gone to. So I got in a program where I was very fortunate to have had some fantastic teachers at Emory. One of the past presidents of the National Council of Teachers of Math was one of my instructors. And I just learned a ton of stuff about math, and in the process learned about the math that was being taught. National Science Foundation also set up a program where it would pay for master's degrees if teachers would go back and work on them. So National Science Foundation essentially paid for the degree. And I learned a lot of math while I was there. In fact, I learned a lot about how much I didn't know. And that was one of the reasons for going back to graduate school later to work on a doctorate. Mm-hmm. When I started in the program at Georgia State, they didn't officially have a doctorate when I started, but they said it was in the works and they'd probably get it. And so I was one of the first two graduates from that program. Two of us graduated in the same ceremony. Mm-hmm. But her name started with a D, so she graduated before I did. But we're the first two from Georgia State in that program in 1973. And it gave a good leg up on study of math and math curriculum. And my interest there was geometry. And in fact, the summer after that was over, the first book that I worked on was with this Iris Dayab, who graduated at the same time. We spent the summer, she was a high school teacher, and we spent the summer writing a transformational geometry book, which is still in print, mm-hmm. without revision. I mean, from 1973 to 2007, basically, that's a pretty long life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's been a good run. And I mentioned the National Council of Teachers of Math and the person who was the faculty member at Emory there, because that became kind of a lifelong interest that continued even here. And I later was elected president of that. But it's through a whole variety of things that we can talk about later if you want to, yeah. or not if you don't. Yeah. I don't know where you want to go. So.
Well, you know, I kind of want to go back to when you first got here. You didn't mention what position you were hired as. What were you teaching? I guess describe the department, your role in it, some of the faculty, student interests.
Sure. When I got here, if you look at the whole history of the math department, I will throw a little of this in, but when you look at the whole history of the math department, it has a very long history of having faculty members who stayed most of their careers. Okay, the first faculty member was a woman, Cynthia Riley. She was one of the original faculty members on campus, and she was around for about 10 years. She'd been a high school teacher here in Missoula and in other places before she came west. But one of the strongest chairs that they had was N.J. Lennis, Niels Lennis, who was here for about 40 years. And there are other faculty members like that. So the department had been really stable from its inception until probably the 60s, 50s or 60s. And in the late 60s, they had hired some people in mathematics education, late 60s, early 70s. Rick Bilstein actually finished his doctorate here, and he was a faculty member. Shlomo Libeskind had immigrated from Poland and Israel and finished his doctorate in Michigan and then came to the University of Montana, and he was in mathematics education. Alan Hoffer was a third one who was here in mathematics education. Alan left and went on to the University of Oregon. But when I got here, Alan had already gone, so there was Rick and Shlomo in math ed, and Shlomo wanted to leave, so there was Rick and Johnny then in math ed. The classes that I taught, the one that I remember the most, quite frankly, I had two sets of classes that I taught. One was a math for elementary teachers class, which wound up playing a huge part in the whole history of my being here anyway, because Rick, Shlomo, and I wound up writing one of the better-selling textbooks in that area for colleges that's in its ninth edition now. But I taught that class, and then we had a class, Math 30123. It was a year-long sequence when we were on the quarter system, just called Math for Secondary Teachers. The first quarter was basically logic proof, stuff of that nature. Second quarter was some number theory, and the last quarter was geometry, and I'd written a dissertation in geometry, so it was a great fit for me. Turned out to be just a nice mix. The department has always had some separate interests and sects. There was an algebra interest group, an analysis interest group, a statistics interest group, and then the math ed interest group. So that was kind of the way the department was divided. Mm-hmm. Now, it's changed and morphed a little over the years, and there have been other sectors added. I mean, you've still got those basic ones, but there's a discrete math group or a combinatorics operations research type group now that wasn't there before. And then there was an applied math group, too. So it's changed some along the way, but it's still got its same basic set of people. There were fewer than 20 faculty members when I got here. The chair of the department was Charles Bryan, who still lives here in town. He was another one of those. He was a Montana person from Livingston who actually got his degree at Montana State College, his undergraduate degree, and then I believe he got his doctorate in Arizona, but he was back as department chair. And at some point in the late 50s or 60s, the department had changed its whole style of how it was run from having a kind of chairman who was chair for a long period of time to having a three-year rotating chairmanship. So Charles was chairman in one of his last years as chairman when I first got here. And then we had a whole series of chairs after that. And I was chair for a short time at one point in there, too. So it's been a good department. It was a collegial department. Bob McKelvey was one of the faculty members who was here when I got here. And he had brought with him a National Science Foundation program to enhance or improve the doctoral program and give it some new emphasis in mathematics. So with that, he was able to bring new faculty members in. So when I got here in 74, there had been two or three or four new faculty members just added in the last couple of years. Bill Derrick came, McKelvey came, Stan Grossman came, George Vitruba came. I'm not sure that's all, but there were three or four that just came right there to help that doctoral program get started. And it was a good fit for me, and the department was and continued to be for a very long time a very collegial kind of place with people kind of respecting each other's works. One of the things that I always liked about the department was in its unit standards, when unit standards were finally written for promotions and merits and things of that nature, there was a statement in there that says different things are, there are different expectations of different people. Where the math ed group, of which I was a part, and the statisticians kind of generally in that era, were expected to do a lot of service work, work with teachers. We, and specifically in math ed, were expected to be involved in schools and the Montana Council of Teachers of Mathematics, where people in the other areas of mathematics were more research-oriented. And so it was just, It was a different world. I'm not saying a better world. It was a different world than what you see today. Mm-hmm. Okay, because as the doctoral program developed, there got to be more of an interest and emphasis on research all around, including in math ed. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the department changed over the period of time, as one would expect. So,
So I want you to follow up a little more on a couple of things.
Sure.
You know, you've mentioned twice specifically how the military or war has affected math in general, right, or your career. Going back to Sputnik, the new math movement, okay, coming out of that, and then your movement into math, sure, as a way or as an alternative to the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And you sort of implied that, you know, you weren't the only person at the time interested in doing that. You also said that the department had just grown when you got here by a few positions. Was that partially due as well to the Vietnam War? You know, we also often associate emphasis or funding in the sciences and math with military,
mm-hmm,
research and development. Am I making an untrue connection there?
I don't think you're making an untrue connection. I'm not sure it's quite as strong right here, uh-huh, as maybe even I implied. First, let me just tell you about me, and I won't pull any punches. I mean, I graduated from college in 1965, mm-hmm, when there was a big push and the military was growing and people were being drafted right and left. I had a graduate assistantship to work on a master's in math right then. And I was talking to my father, who was a World War II vet, and he said, before you do this and go to graduate school, you should talk to the draft board and see what's going to happen. And small county, you could call up and say, what will happen if I go to graduate school? I did, and was told quite honestly that I might be there 3 months. And at the end of that time, they'd probably draft me. Small county, and they were looking for everybody they could to fill their quotas. Since I had a degree in teaching anyway, that was part of it, and I was offered a job almost immediately as a teacher. In fact, I'd already been offered a job before I got this assistantship. I decided to take it. That was before even the lottery system in the draft, and I had two classifications for most of my career. One was 1A, which was every summer, and then I was reclassified to a much higher classification that would get me drafted. Excuse me, it was... 1A every summer, which was the highest draft category you could have, and I get a lower classification during the year when I was teaching. So I never knew from year to year whether I was going to be drafted or not. Some of my friends who were teachers were drafted right out of the classroom. I wasn't. Math and science were kind of sacred right that minute because we needed people who could work in those areas. And then when the lottery system came along and they were drawing numbers, I got a very high... I mean, or very low, depending on how you look at it. It was not likely that I was going to be drafted with that, mm-hmm, number. So I was still teaching in schools anyway when that happened, but it didn't matter. But it had a huge effect on my life. It turned out, for the wrong reasons, I may have gotten into teaching for the wrong reasons as a way to somewhat avoid the draft. But it turned out to be one of the best decisions I ever made, because working with students is what's basically made my whole career, I think. I always liked working with students, and I liked teaching, and as I said, I probably got here for the wrong reasons, but I think it worked pretty well. In terms of this campus, in the 60s before I got here, I guess this was a pretty interesting and radical place from everything I've read and heard about it. The doctoral program that McKelvey brought with him was not so much because of the war or the war effort. There was a movement then, as there has continued to be, to try to train mathematicians to be better teachers, okay? Because many mathematicians go through and they're researchers, but they have no background in teaching. So his program that he brought here for that doctoral program had some special emphases with some special classes that students would take, the doctoral students would take, to try to prepare them to teach. One of them was simply called a college teaching class, okay, where you really examined all the facets that a small college university math type might have to work in and know something about in order to survive in an era like that. It included publishing, but it also included how to teach and different strategies for teaching and all the things along those lines. It was an innovative program at the time, and we had a number of very good graduate students go out of here. We've had a number of good graduate students for over a long period of time, but every person who graduated had job offers, and almost automatically. And this was in an era, I mean, you go through lots of eras here where there are people who are really needed, and then you go through an era where they're not so much needed. When we had many mathematicians who immigrated from Eastern Europe, there was a time where jobs were hard to come by, but our students still seemed to find jobs over all the years. And I think it's a large part a result of Bob's program. So,
the other thing you mentioned that always catches my ears, you said the department was very collegial when you first came. Just describe that. I mean, what do you mean by collegial? That sort of brings to mind good stories.
Well, there are any number of good stories, okay? And I'm not saying the department didn't have arguments, okay? Because the department's always going to have arguments. But one of the most, in general, it seemed to me that the faculty members respected other faculty members in different areas, like the algebraist would not think badly of the math educators, you know, and vice versa. I mean, pick your area. I'm not picking on algebra right this minute. That's not always the case in math departments, especially in relation to mathematics education, because mathematics education is a fairly young field in mathematics that's really has probably only got a 50-year history. So maybe 60, but I don't think it's any... It could go back any further than that. So it's always been kind of the new kid on the block and kind of suspect. And this department gives a pretty good, this university gives a pretty good mix of that, because there have been as many as 5 math educators in the math department and then 2 in the School of Education. And usually with pretty good working relationships all the way up and down the line. But there was always a question of where this group of people might be housed. Do they belong in mathematics because they aren't doing pure math research, or do they belong in education? But they're not really doing pure education research either. So it's a group that's had to find its way, and it's had a pretty good life here, I think.
Why has the university or the department chosen to encourage math education in that way?
I can't talk about how I decided to make that move in the first place, because that was before I got here. You might want to interview Rick Bilstein just as an example, because he came here as a graduate student. Okay, but one of the things he did, and he's a part of the math ed history in this school, was that for his dissertation, he did a dissertation that had to do with the remedial or developmental math classes, which was something the department needed and needed to know something about right then. So almost immediately after he graduated, he was in charge of that program. And I think even before he graduated, he was in charge of that program. So he just kind of naturally merged into the department. He grew up in Billings and had come here and was a part of it. I don't know how Alan Hoffer was hired, who was the other early math educator. But then Shlomo was hired pretty much to follow Alan. And so it had 2 people to start with. And then when Shlomo did come back and I was offered the job, we had 3 in math ed. And from there it grew. We were successful in getting a number of grants over the years, and some of them were huge, that's built math ed. We've had a small master's program that was already started. It started out the National Science Foundation grants. For the same way I got my master's at Emory, they had a program similar to that here that Ballard, Myers, Reinhardt, Gloria Hewitt, and others had established here. So they had a master's program for teachers that had been fairly successful. So when Rick and Shlomo and I came along, I mean, our goal was to kind of continue that and keep it growing. And then along the way, and this is all the way up into the late 80s or 90s, mathematics education was added as one of the emphases that you could get a doctorate in. So, and we've had a few students, a handful, not too many. We never tried to grow that program very much because there weren't many of us. Mm-hmm. And you need a pretty strong group in order to make a doctoral program go. But Heidi Keck, who was one of my advisees and was one of the first ones to finish, is at Western Colorado College. And pretty outstanding faculty member. Her husband got a degree in pure mathematics at the same time. So they made a pretty good couple. Mm-hmm. But But I don't know. I maybe didn't answer your question.
Well, you know, you said we weren't trying to grow that in terms of the PhD program. How did it come about then? Was it student interest? Or was there just demand?
There was demand. Mm-hmm. I mean, the truth of the matter is, as long as there were two or three of us here in mathematics education, we had our hands full working with the prospective elementary teachers and the prospective secondary teachers and working with a master's program. I mean, with three people, that kept us busy 12 months out of the year, basically, if you wanted to. And we spent a lot of time working with the Montana Council of Teachers of Mathematics, which is a small state organization and had its roots both here and at Montana State. And so we did a lot of service work with those. We spent a lot of time in the field working with teachers. And then the grant started. Rick had an early grant. There was a grant that kind of combined the Montana Department of Education, Office of Public Instruction, okay, Montana State, University of Montana. And I think at that stage it also had Dillon and Billings and Northern involved in it. So it was kind of a partnership. And one of the early grants had to do with the metric system, because that was when we were having a huge pitch switch, I mean a huge pitch to move to the metric system. So that was one of the earlier ones that Rick was involved in. Mm-hmm. And then there were a series of other grants over the years, and there's no way I could remember all of them at this point, but I mean, I had several grants where I worked with very bright high school kids in the summer. I brought them to campus, and they lived here for 6 to 8 weeks in the summer with counselors and studied math every day. And so that was another kind of big push that we had for a while. And then we were successful in getting a number of teacher preparation grants doing professional development with teachers in schools. One of the more successful programs that Rick and I worked with here on this campus in Montana State was also involved. It was called the EMMI program, the Excellence in Montana Mathematics Education. And it was designed purely and simply to bring elementary teachers back to campus. And over a period of 2 summers, and they had to come for 2 summers, we would teach them both math content and methods to try to update them and their skills. And the truth of the matter is, with the program going both here at the University of Montana and at Montana State, we worked in conjunction on the thing the whole way, we produced the leaders in mathematics education for, well, they're still in leadership positions in this state. Many of them are beginning to retire now. So, but following up on that and working with the Montana Math Council, a group of the MCTM leaders, and the MCTM is Montana Council of Teachers of Mathematics, met in the basement over in the math building. And our whole thing was, what should we do to push mathematics education in the state next? There had been the EMMI program, which was for elementary teachers. There had been a separate program that Rick had worked on for high school teachers, integrating mathematics and computer technology. I don't have that. It's IMPACT was the acronym, and I can't remember all the right words. But that had brought high school teachers together. So we'd had these two very successful programs. And the next thing was, what would we do? We sat in the basement and simply dreamed. And one of the things was, well, we should write an integrated math program for high schools. Just change the whole curriculum in the high schools, because that seems to me like one of the things that we need to do. Many European countries and Asian countries use integrated mathematics, but the United States programs had always been different, with an Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2 kind of track for high schools, where in integrated math, you'd bring all the math topics together, blend them, and put together some kind of coherent package that could be a high school program. So that became one of the dreams. Not the only one, but that was one of them. And we were in the process of trying to write a grant, again, involving the colleges, Montana State, University of Montana primarily, and the Office of Public Instruction, to do that, when we got an opportunity. Dan Dolan, who was the mathematics coordinator in the Office of Public Instruction, found out that we might could get some money from the Exxon Educational Foundation. We wrote a small grant to the Exxon Foundation, asked them for about $50,000 to do a survey of schools in the nation about integrated mathematics. One, to try to define it. What would that mean if you use that term? And then two, was there any interest in moving toward that kind of curriculum? And it was one of the strangest grants we had ever written. I mean, it was to a private foundation. And when the letter came back thanking us for the award, it had a check attached to it for the, it was roughly $48,000, I think. They didn't quite give us $50,000, but it was very close. Mm-hmm. But it was attached to it. And it's like, here, go do it. So we did. We did a small grant that was finished in about 1990, trying to define what integrated math was. And we found out that people were saying there was huge interest in such a program in the country. And we were told in that survey that the schools could move there within 3 to 5 years, which we didn't believe because nothing moves that fast in education. I don't care what it is. But anyway, that's what we're told. So it gave us a good springboard because National Science Foundation at the same time had developed another program asking for states to do systemic initiatives. And in the systemic initiative, what you had to do is agree to change everything a state did in mathematics or science right then. It was one or the other in its initial stages. Well, we already had this foundation laid that we could change the high school curriculum. We could work with the teachers and do those. We could work with the universities to try to train teachers in some different ways that they'd been doing. And we thought, we got a great shot at doing this. So we wrote the grant proposal and submitted to the National Science Foundation with Dan as the director. And it was funded. By the time it was funded, Dan had married someone from Connecticut and moved. So Maurice Burke over at Montana State and I took it over and directed that project. But we hired writers who were high school teachers from Montana and all across the nation, and we wrote an entire high school curriculum. And along the way, there were kind of five components to that, and the university was deeply involved in the whole piece because the commissioner of higher ed at that point, whose name escapes me right this minute, but I could think of it if I work on it for a minute, agreed that the University of Montana and Montana State would work actively in this. And they would not fight over who got what out of it. So the grant was funded to the Montana Council of Teachers of Mathematics, and it was for $10 million, with the University of Montana having a subcontract, Montana State having a subcontract. Office of Public Instruction had very little of it in the final analysis, but those three were the major partners. And we went about dividing the program up. The first summer, it was all on this campus, where we had people coming to work with do the professional development of teachers. We had writers writing material. The writers would write material, give it to the professional development types. They'd try to teach it to the teachers the next day. They'd react to it. We'd rewrite it. This went on for, well, the initial grant lasted for 5 years. And we had to add science late in the process. So we actually wound up hiring the state coordinator in science. And before it was over, we paid for the state math coordinator, where the Office of Public Instruction finally did away with that job. But any royalties that were earned on these materials, and they are still being published by Kendall Hunt Publishing Company, one chunk of the royalties goes to Montana Math Council. Small chunk goes to the University of Montana, which is set up in a math ed trust fund. Small amount, same equivalent amount, goes to Montana State. And then the writers get tiny amounts. And I mean truly tiny at that stage. But it's a program that was used in many places in Montana. It was important because, I mean, for the state, not just because it tied together the two major universities, but it also tied in the Office of Public Instruction. And before it was over, the legislature had given us $1 million to put technology in the schools. And literally, it was one of those things where in the last moments of one of the legislature meetings, when they'd stopped the clock, as they usually do to things, it was like, okay, here's the SIMS project. We have to do something with it. And that's what it was called, SIMS. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll put $1 million in it. Where are we going to put it? Well, you couldn't give it to Montana Math Council because that wasn't a state agency. So somebody said, give it to Montana State. And that was a huge nightmare for Montana State because all of a sudden they have this money that has to go to schools and they have no way to manage it. So we had to manage that for them. And so we put technology in schools, trained 75% of the high school teachers in the state. Project's still going. I mean, the money's run out, but the curriculum's still going. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's interesting because almost all the developments you've talked about, you've correlated with grants, private funding. And here we are at what's, you know, in name anyway, a state school, right?
Right.
And that's the first mention I've heard of actual state money, though your programs have been explicitly directed at public education.
Absolutely.
You know, and I know
the funding for the state has never been great in education. Okay.
And I know that that certainly has been a historical trend at this university as well as most public universities, that it's more grant research funded. Is math ahead of the curve on that?
Math had been for a long time ahead of the curve. Okay. In the last administration and the current administration, the money that had gone to math and science education, was a lot of it was stripped away from the National Science Foundation and given to the Department of Education. And then it was turned into state block grants. And it was dissipated, in my opinion, to the point that it was far less effective than it ever was when it was at National Science Foundation. And I'm not saying that because, or only because I had a huge grant. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is, when it's dissipated like that and it goes to a state agency and then it's distributed to the schools, in that method, you don't have a focus or a state focus, where with a state systemic initiative, and there's been tons of stuff written about those state systemic initiatives. Not every state had one. There were all maybe 21 or 22 that got them. But they had a huge impact on some states. Now, the amount of money, $10 million, is not a drop in the bucket to some states like New York and California, who had and both states had these kinds of grants. But for Montana, it was a gigantic amount of money. Mm-hmm. And we could take that and actually get it to the schools where it could do some good. And putting the technology in the schools and training the teachers at no cost, I mean, absolutely no cost, was amazing. We got the $1 million in state match from the legislature. In fact, we had a couple of $1 million before it was over from the state legislature to put technology in schools. And at one point, and this is in the early 90s, Montana probably had more technological equipment per student than any state in the nation. I mean, if you don't keep that kind of thing up, then it loses over a period of time. But our goal, we went out and measured classrooms and talked about what was realistic to put in a classroom, because we knew that schools weren't going to build new facilities for this technology. But we finally figured out that we could put about one computer for every four kids in the classroom. In the early 90s, when we started this, it would probably cost $40,000 to outfit one classroom, which is totally outrageous. And we knew that it was outrageous at the time. But among the other things that we did in this grant was to form some partnerships with Texas Instruments. And Texas Instruments was in the process of developing the TI-92 calculator, which was a programmable calculator. Tiny little thing, $165 each, which would do much of what you would expect a computer to do at that stage. So we went from a $40,000 per classroom cost to having those little calculators that every kid could have one of. Mm-hmm. You can check them out like textbooks, and you could do the same thing for $6,000. So it was a huge project for the mm-hmm. state, and it's had many ramifications. Montana Math Council and Montana Science Teachers Association were huge beneficiaries of this, but especially the Math Council. It gave them money to do scholarships and to continue having a pretty impressive program mm-hmm. up to today. One of the things that they work on now in conjunction with the Science Teachers Organization is the Montana Learning Center, where they have taken over the houses that were built there on the Missouri River when they were building the dam at Canyon Ferry, and that now is a learning center for math and science. So they have about 15 houses there that they use now and have programs there. And I mean, that's one of the far-fetched outcomes of this project, but I mean, it gave a little bitty council of never more than 500 members ever. Okay, even in its heyday, when it was it formed a partnership with Apple, where it was one of the first kind of private entities. It wasn't a company that would sell computers at cost to teachers. Mm-hmm. That's when it had its most members, because people would join the Montana Math Council if they didn't have anything to do with math, simply to buy a computer cheap. Uh-huh. And these were Apple IIs and Apple IIes, so it's been a while ago. But this is one of those. What I've tried to give you is through these grants, and I mean, that's not the only one. There have been others, but others can talk about them. Rick Bilstein, for example, has still going the STEM project, which is 6 through 8 mathematics, which was develop a middle school curriculum. It was set up in a different way through a different piece of National Science Foundation, but it too was to develop the middle school part of this, okay, where we've developed a high school part and they would work together. But we spent a ton of time trying to get the university working with schools and with teachers. And I think it's been a successful relationship mm-hmm. all along the line. And along the way, as well as working with the other public schools, we didn't spend much time working with Montana Tech because it didn't have a teacher preparation program. But we worked with the others. And we also worked with Carroll College. And a little bit, but less so, with Rocky. Mm-hmm. So we had almost all the schools in the state. We didn't have University of Great Falls, but we also had input from the tribal schools, because one of the goals of that project was to try to write curricular materials that would have a Montana or a Native American emphasis. So many of our examples were chosen with Native Americans in mind, and many of the modules and lessons that still exist are based on those things. We had training sessions where we'd invite people from the tribes to come and talk to us about what we might do and how we might use the math that is kind of natural to the tribes in our math program.
That's interesting. You know, usually when you think of the last few years in the movement to better Indian education in this state, the focus is history, teaching mm-hmm. of history, for example. You don't think of math having a Native American emphasis right. to it.
Well, I'll give you one example. I mean, this is an example that we've used many times, but with some of the tribes in the eastern part of the state, quilting, which wasn't part of their kind of natural native history, but it's something that they've adapted over the years, and there's a great ceremony that's still done in some of the schools at basketball games where a student will choose either a teacher or someone from the community, and the people in the community will quilt a quilt of different, you know, some variety, and then the basketball ceremony, they'll wrap the person in a quilt, and that's the way it's presented. And there's a great module that we wrote on traditional design is the title of it, but it has to do with quilting, and some of the quilting features and some part of this ceremony is in there. I mean, that's just, it's a stretch, but we were trying to find things that were a part of the, not just the ancient history of the native tribes, but also today's history. Mm-hmm. You know, how can we integrate this in to make mm-hmm. it more interesting to everybody? And we took some criticism for it, by the way, simply because it was a Montana curriculum in its beginning, mm-hmm. more than a national curriculum. It turned out to be a national curriculum, but some of it's had to be changed along the way, too.
So one element I haven't heard you talk sure. a lot about is relationship between what you were doing, what the department was doing, and administration here on campus.
Well, that one's been interesting, because when I first came here, under President Bowers, okay, and I had been here maybe 2 years or so, when as a very young faculty member, I was put on one of the retrenchment committees, which is one of the most painful experiences I ever had in this university. It had nothing to do necessarily with President Bowers, but it was one of those periods where the university had to slash its budget again, and it was at a time when it was like, okay, you have to identify programs that aren't pulling their weight or doing whatever, and we have to do something with it. I spent a year on that committee as a young faculty member, and we did finally make some recommendations. But the net result of that, I think, and I could be a little wrong here, is one part-time faculty member in Italian who was retiring. The Italian program was done away with at that stage. And that might be the only visible result out of all of that. It was really painful for me personally. So,
it's all right.
So I tried to stay away from that aspect of life here on this campus mm-hmm. as much as I could. I was on the Faculty Senate for a while. I was on the Executive Committee of the Senate for a while. It's one of those things where I've never been, I have to choose my words very carefully here, but I'm going to say them anyway. I've never been super impressed by the way the Faculty Senate has operated. It's never seemed to be an effective way of governing a campus, and there's a strange dichotomy between administrative views and faculty views and union views, and they're sort of all merged, you know. And even though I was active on it for a while, I tried to stay away from it as much as I can. I've tried to work in other ways, okay? I've never said no to committees if I thought I could do something. So I've served on unit standards committees, and I think those have a lot of value, where departments have to sit down and try to decide what it is that's important for merits and promotions and things of that nature. I think that was important. Years ago, I was on the editorial board of the College of Arts and Science Forum, which is a now defunct publication, but it was a publication where we actually did articles about people on campus and things that were important on campus. And I worked on that with Howard Reinhardt, who later became dean of the College of Arts mm-hmm. and Sciences, but he was a former department chair in the math department too. And that was something that was really fun, and it was good to do. I enjoyed that. Along the way, I mean, I have had some other interesting kind of out of the ordinary sorts of experiences, but both my wife and I were on a national committee for NCAA. We have no background in athletics, either one of us, okay? But she was in the School of Ed and later was chair of the Department of Curriculum and Instruction, and I was in the math department, and from our work with mine with the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics and hers with the National Council of Teachers of English, at the same time, we were appointed to the core committee, or the committee that studied the core requirements in academics for athletics. Mm-hmm. So here she was as an English representative, and here I am as a math representative on the same committee. That was pretty interesting because we worked to try to get a little bit more coherence into some of those core courses that high schools could use for athletes and count as college-intending courses that the athletes had to have. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was something that we were there, in some sense, representing the University of Montana, but truly representing National Council of Teachers of Math and National Council of Teachers of English. So it was another strange kind of set of circumstances mm-hmm. that led a husband-wife team to be on the same committee mm-hmm. for NCAA, but it worked, I guess. I haven't talked much about the administration at all. Right before I came here, there was an article in Time magazine describing the University of Montana as a graveyard of presidents. And I have to admit that in my early years here, we had quite a few mm-hmm. Until President Denison came along and added some stability. This, because of the money and the funding of the university system, I can't imagine having his job or being president of this university. Over a long period of time, the funding has been so rocky at times. The academics are affected. I mean, you're affected in small ways. I'll give you an example for the math department. And it's in some ways continues today because salaries are lower here than almost anywhere in the nation. You have a hard time finding faculty members. Right now, they're in their third search to replace me in mathematics education in the department. The first two failed because they didn't make offers, but the people went to other places for more money mm-hmm. and for other reasons. It's hard to do. And some of us have made decisions to stay here regardless of salaries because I think the benefits of being here have been tremendous. Mm-hmm. And I'll use myself simply as an example. I had other opportunities along the way, but the department and the administration here was supportive for me to do different kinds of work. And not necessarily mainstream academic work. That grant that I just described, the SIMS project, was one that kept me out of the classroom for 5 years. And we did hire people behind me to replace me, but they gave me the freedom to do that kind of thing because it was important to the state. I think it was important to the campus. And there are other examples like that that you can give along the way, but it was a very supportive department and in general a supportive administration when you came up with something like that that you wanted to do. And they gave, I had a number of small bits of help along the way. I mean, I had three sabbaticals while I was here. And one of them, they gave me the freedom to go teach in a small fishing village in Alaska for a year to go back and work with kids again. One of them, I was able to work on a geometry book. And the third one was less successful, primarily because I had a car accident that interrupted a lot of the work that was supposed to be done then. But I was given the opportunity, three opportunities like that anyway. And so the administration was very supportive of me, just personally. I have no complaints at all. I sometimes worried about the money and what we were doing and finding new faculty members. But there are some funny stories along the way. I mean, among them is trying to get the math building itself renovated and up to shape. I mean, it started out as a women's dorm and as Craig Hall, I guess it was. Not the original, is the original Craig Hall, not the one we have now, but it started out as a women's dorm and later morphed into a math and physics department and then later just into a math department. But when you go look at that building, I mean, it's clear it wasn't built as a classroom building. And now, over 100 years later, they are putting an elevator on the back of it. But that elevator was something that we worked on for over 20 years, trying to get it in that building, you know. There have been times where it needed paint, it needed updating desperately, and there was never money to do it. President Dennison told us at one point that if we could go out and raise the money, he'd make sure that we got a building built, but we had to go raise the money. And there have been little things done, but it's still a building in vast need of renovation in my mind. It's one of those buildings that I like the outside structure. If they could keep the outside structure and gut the inside and start over, it might be really a great place. But it's one of those things where at different times you would wander in and wonder, how could an apartment be in here? It's not quite that way now, but it has had a number of renovations in terms of putting technology in there. One of the things that SIMS project did for this university was it gave the initial money to put two computer labs in that building. We bought the original equipment and had those two rooms redesigned for computer labs. So that was one of the grant's contributions to the university. And the research part of the university was super helpful in doing that. Ray Murray was the person in charge of the research then, and he was extraordinarily helpful in making that happen. Because one of the things that he was willing to do is let us use part of the university's indirect costs to do that. And that's helped that department. I mean, it's changed a number of times since we finished that 15 years ago, or not 15 years ago, it's getting close, about 11 years ago, I guess. But it's changed a number of times over the years since then to be upgraded. But the initial money came out of the SIMS project to do that. In fact, they're still labeled as the SIMS labs.
You know, this may not be an easy question to answer, but how much has technology changed math or the teaching of math? I mean, you know, is the computer not essentially different than a piece of paper and a pencil? It's just a different medium on which you do math? Or does it, in fact, change math and change the teaching of math?
You get a very biased opinion from me.
Okay.
And I'll give you a little bit of history. One of the first projects, calculator projects, that was done in Montana. And Art Wilson was a graduate student in education. He was my advisee, along with Levon Kuster, who was in education at that point. But Art did one of the very first calculator studies in grade schools to try to decide how calculator usage affected grade school kids learning in mathematics. And it, along with all the subsequent studies, have consistently said that kids who use technology, and I'm going to expand it here from calculators to graphing calculators to computers, that kids who learn math using those tools have not hurt their traditional skills any, and they're better able to solve problems in general than are kids who don't use those tools.
Mm-hmm.
So you find people who are very traditional in mathematics, but the research essentially says that they can learn better, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
than they do without it. It's not the same. You're not learning the same way. You're not learning exactly the same things, but you aren't hurting the traditional skills. There was always a worry with young kids that they would not learn the multiplication tables if they used calculators. Well, it doesn't seem to have hurt them any. There was only one study in fourth grade out of all the multitude of studies that have been done that said the kids might have been hurt. Okay? And there have been many studies
mm-hmm.
before and since Allen that have not agreed with it. But, I mean, that's continued. And math keeps changing. It doesn't always change in the departments as fast. The university is really slow to change when it comes to some stuff like that. Many of the calculus classes are taught with technology now. Pre-calculus and graphing calculators, they're almost an automatic to help students learn concepts. And in high schools, especially, graphing calculators is a necessity. Using Excel as a spreadsheet to do math and a graphing calculator, it's just common. In many cases, far more common than it is here on campus.
Mm-hmm.
The university's been slower to change.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the classes and the way they're taught with linear algebra, some of the calculus, some of the upper division stuff, it's used all the time. One of the classes that came in with the Sims project here was using math modeling with technology to work with teachers. And, excuse me. This course was actually designed for secondary teachers as a result of the Sims project to try to get teachers, prospective teachers, ready to teach out of that project. Can we turn that off for a second? Let me get something to drink.
Okay. Are we ready?
Yep. I don't even know where we were. So.
Well, you know, I wanted to... You were talking about technology and it, in fact, studies showing that it, in fact, improved students' ability to learn. You know, this is a question I suspect I know your answer to, but I'm going to ask it anyway because there's a pretty common perception that math, maybe more than anything, is that subject that people either get or they don't. You're either inclined to math or you're not. Yet you've spent your entire career in math education, which I assume would speak to the idea that that's not necessarily true.
Well, I'm one of those people who thinks every kid can learn mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm not one of those people who think that what we're necessarily doing in mathematics is the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I mentioned the Integrated Math Project. Because one of our goals in that project was to try to write a curriculum that students would be interested in. And one of the ways to get students interested is simply give them challenging problems. Things that interest them that can challenge them. And that's not the traditional form of mathematics. Because you're not learning math by rote. One of the things we learned in the process is you do need to do some practice, which in our first round of that curriculum had very little practice in it. And so we learned a pretty painful lesson along the way, too, and that is that we had to put more practice in there. We could get the kids sucked into the mathematics and get them involved in it, but they have to practice some of the skills that they learn along the way. But I do many... You hit on perception... of there are some people that can learn mathematics and some people that can't learn mathematics. This is an old line, and it's one that you hear all the time. You would never hear people in the United States say, I can't read, or I don't like reading. But they're more than happy to tell you, I hate math,
I can't do math.
Right. Okay, and they're happy to pass that on to their kids, mm-hmm. where they would never do that about reading.
Mm-hmm.
And... I was president of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. It's an organization of about 100,000 teachers. It's the biggest one in the world, okay? And that's one of the things this university let me do is they let me take the time off to do that. One of my pushes was mathematics literacy for all. It's hard to define what mathematical literacy is. Mm-hmm. What does a person need to know to function as a mathematically literate adult? Okay, and can we give them that up through high school so that they can continue that, or at least know that they can do mathematics along the way? Well, I think that we can. I don't think we're always good at it. But one definition, and a lot of people wouldn't accept this, but I kept saying, if you simply have adults who can read and understand the mathematics in USA Today, a common newspaper written at about 7th or 8th grade level, essentially, that might be mathematically literate enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because the mathematics sit there, some of the mathematics that's in that newspaper is fairly sophisticated. And one of the classes that we have here that was most recently taught by Dr. Rudy Gideon, who's a former math department faculty member who is now retired. But his wife had surgery last year, and I got to go teach that class. And one of the things that I did was simply cut graphs out of USA Today and took them into the class and gave them to the members and said, okay, here's the math that you've got for your article for today. What's the headline? I mean, and our whole thing was, can you interpret those graphs? Mm-hmm. And that is a form of mathematical literacy. And that's one of the things that adults have to be able to do when they pick up that newspaper and read it. So one of the things, when you ask people what they think mathematical literacy ought to be, that they start talking about most frequently, they're going to talk about statistics and probability. Okay, two topics that until the last 10 or 15 years did not appear as part of any high school curriculum, or it appeared in minor ways. But in the last 15 to 20 years, it's changed. And one of the things that maybe sooner or later will change in the department here is, as a freshman course, or a kind of core math course that might meet a general ed requirement here on this campus, a course in statistics and probability might be a core course that would make more sense than some of the things that we sometimes teach. Mm-hmm. College algebra, in my mind, is not a core course. I mean, because most people don't work with college algebra, or not knowingly work with college algebra anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some implications there that sooner or later the university will face, but it takes a long time for change to happen. I do think that we have to approach the perception of mathematics that adults have, that they pass on to their kids. I think the university has a huge responsibility in doing that. Okay, and one of the things the department has been pretty good about over the years here on campus is going out to schools and talking to kids and talking to adults about things like that. David Patterson, who's the current department chair, has worked with Math Counts, which is a competition for middle school kids. His son has been involved in it, and that may be one of the reasons that he's been involved in it, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. I mean, that's not, he's just one example, but there have been many people like that over the years. And I think anything we can do in that regard helps improve the ties of the university to the school community and to the community at large. One of the things I have to do in January is go give a talk at the Art Museum about art and mathematics. And I've spent an incredible amount of time working on that. Mm-hmm. One of the modules that we wrote in that high school curriculum was called MART, or Math and Art. It was kind of a merger of the two. So one of the things that I'm going to do is talk about some of the ways that math has affected some painters. Mm-hmm. Not all, but some. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that have been used. And I've got some pretty current examples. So.
Well, that's, of course, the other big hurdle or perception to get over with math, right? After, I can't do it, I don't want to do it, why is this important?
Right. And I think that should be in the forefront, both at the university and the high school level. It's always, why is this important? Mm-hmm. It's not that you can give an absolute reason for every piece of every bit of mathematics, but by working on a little bit, you can give tons of examples where it is important. And the kids will know that it's important. You don't have to tell them it's important. They'll know by your examples and your problems that it's important. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're doing polynomial equations or something like that, and you can tie it to compound interest, for example, or some kind of interest, not necessarily compound, there's a way that you can tie that in there that they'll be sucked into learning the mathematics without even knowing what they're, what they're doing. You know, studying population and looking at exponential curves, for example. One of the modules that we wrote in that high school curriculum that we got an award from the governor was on an AIDS module that we wrote. Because in the 90s, when the growth of AIDS was tremendous in terms of number of infected people, we studied it from a statistical and mathematical standpoint. You know, if this goes unchecked, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. All right. And then at the same time, we gave another kind of model that had to do with the decline of the Blackfeet Nation because of smallpox. Mm-hmm. You know, where if you looked at the mathematical model, you'd swear that that whole population would have been decimated and gone. But things happened, mm-hmm. and people adapted. Just like with the AIDS module, you know, the AIDS model, new medicines were adapted, and things changed. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things where the mathematical model doesn't quite fit the real world, but you didn't have to give kids a reason for studying that. I mean, simply looking at the numbers and looking at the graphs gave them a reason for mm-hmm. doing it. Mm-hmm. We took a little bit of flack over the AIDS module.
Well, I was going to say, you know, suddenly you've got math, which is not generally considered very politicized.
Absolutely.
And it makes me immediately think of, all right, what do I see graphs about all the time right now? Global warming.
Sure.
You know, you couldn't think of a more politicized topic right now, perhaps, and this is math.
Well, and just to give you a little bit more about the department, one of the things that it has every year, it celebrates Math Awareness Week, and we've done this through a variety of modes and models, but one of the speakers a few years ago that I was actually able to bring in was someone from the University of Washington who talked about global warming. And, I mean, this is now maybe 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. but it was incredible. And he was leaving here to go to the North Pole area to study the thickness of ice, mm-hmm. you know. It's pretty phenomenal. But we've tried to do things in that department that would pull people in. And sometimes it's politicized, sometimes it's not. But we did a staged reading of Arcadia, a play by Tom Stoppard, that there were several underlying messages there. Well, one of those underlying messages was girls could learn math and they can learn it very well. Okay. And, I mean, that was one of the hidden messages that was there. It wasn't so hidden, but mm-hmm. We did a stage reading with the help of the drama department mm-hmm. to do that 1 year for Math Awareness Week.
So is it true? Girls in math?
Girls in math are great. they do as well as boys do. Yeah. And at this stage, there are more girls and women in math at the, kind of majoring in math at the high school level and at the undergraduate level. And there are guys. In fact, it's kind of a reverse problem now. Mm-hmm. There are fewer guys going into math.
It seems, if you know, statistics, if I'm remembering statistics right, that's true of university educations in general.
Yeah. Well, at the graduate level, it is still the case in the doctoral programs that there are more men than there are women. Mm-hmm. That's changing slightly, but it'll take a while.
So how's that being reflected in the faculty? Is it...
There are, oh, I can tell you that one pretty clearly. I told you that the first person in the math department was a woman, mm-hmm. Cynthia Riley. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you look at the tenure track positions in the university, one of the next ones was Gloria Hewitt, who didn't get here until 1960. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're talking about from 1893 or 1895 when the university started until 1960 before you got another tenure track faculty member.
That was a woman.
That was a woman. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then there was another little period in there, and there Elizabeth Pusick was another faculty member who was hired who didn't stay very long on a tenure track line. But now if you look at the department, there are, I can't remember, there are 5 or 6 women in a department of about 22. Mm-hmm. So it's changed considerably. Mm-hmm. And it was time. I mean, purely and simply, it was time. But Gloria was... I believe the 3rd African-American woman to get a PhD in mathematics in the United States. Mm-hmm. And she spent her whole career here on this campus mm-hmm. and was a department chair. That's something that had a lot to say for this department, I think. had a lot to say for her for putting up with this department too for a long period of time where she was the only woman. But she did an outstanding job as chair. She served a 3-year term was normal for a chair, and she served longer than that, mm-hmm. and then retired. But she was very instrumental in doing some things in the department. Among the things that she had studied and learned was that departments that wrote answers to their comprehensive exams for master's and doctoral students, where students could go look at them and study them, had a higher pass rate. So that's one of the things that she instituted, you know, in her chairmanship. I don't know whether that's still going on or not, but it was something that she had some research to back it up. She's also one of the people for the department who actually helped establish a scholarship program, put it on a pretty good financial foundation. She took that as one of her goals, and she, with working through the foundation, she got some help mm-hmm. in setting that up. So she's pretty outstanding.
So thinking of instrumental things that have happened in the department, you've mentioned that you are on the National Mathematics Council.
National Council of Teachers of Mathematics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Served as the president of that.
Right.
You've published some of the longstanding textbooks in the field of math education. When I go talk to someone else mm-hmm. about the math department, what are they going to say? What's the legacy of Johnny Lott? What has Johnny Lott left?
They'll probably start laughing.
I mean,
Gotti's gone.
Put aside modesty here for a minute.
No, I'm serious.
And reiterate your accomplishments, big and small.
I think they will talk about the Sims Project, which I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Okay. The work in the state with mathematics education is huge. I think they'll recognize that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that would probably be first. Mm-hmm. The work as president of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics was a big deal. I mean, I'm not being modest here. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is an elected office, and to have someone from Montana elected to that office is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. Because of the work that we've done here, going back to Bill Stannard, whose son John works with the Upward Bound program here on campus still. Bill was at Eastern Montana College and was the first Montana elected to the board of directors of that National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. And off and on since that time, we've had a steady stream of people elected to that office. Not as president, but elected to that board of directors. Mm-hmm. We have one high school teacher from Helena on that board of directors right now. So it's been pretty constant, pretty steady across many years. I was elected to the board of directors. And being on that board and working with a number of the publications of that council, that's something that would probably be recognized. I don't know how many people will recognize that, but among the things, I was the first. They had a journal for elementary teachers called The Arithmetic Teacher. And then while I was there and as chair of the editorial panel, that one changed to Teaching Children Mathematics. Okay, so it's now one of their stable, long-term running journals. Mm-hmm. I was chair of the editorial panel of Student Math Notes, which is designed for kids for grades 5 through 10. And we started a publication called Math Education Dialogues, where we took on very political topics and tried to present both views. Because of the math wars, this is coming out of the new mathematics era where people revolted against it. Mathematicians in particular revolted against the new mathematics movement. But Math Education Dialogues was a publication that we started and did, and I was chair of that panel. So all those kind of gave me a springboard mm-hmm. to go on and be president of that organization. But that'd probably be recognized first, because I mean, we have Bev Chen here on campus has been president of the National Council of Teachers of English. But she and I mean, those are the two kind of biggest organizations. Mm-hmm. And the math teacher organization is far bigger than the National Council of Teachers of English. But Bev has long been active on a national level. So she's just another person in that line. But I would think that the work with teachers would be first. I might be wrong, but that would be, I think that would be my legacy. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, I don't have any more questions for you unless you'd like to offer some other memories or thoughts about the department.
I can tell you lots of funny stories about the department. I'll tell you one about Gloria Hewitt.
Okay.
When Gloria was chair, Gloria and I like to argue. I mean, I'd put that first, okay? And she's a person whom I sincerely respect. But we had a faculty meeting, and I thought she wasn't listening to anyone and wasn't listening to the faculty, because she had this habit of going, okay, now you didn't vote right on this last time. We're going to reconsider it today if the votes didn't go the way she wanted them to go. I mean, this is pretty normal in her tenure. She'd probably tell you this too, but I know she would tell you this story, because I went up to her office and we kind of had a little yelling match up in her office when she was chair. Then I got really angry and I stormed out of her office and slammed the door and went downstairs. My office was directly below hers in the math building. In less than 2 minutes, she stormed into my office and she says something along the lines of, honey, let me teach you how to slam a door. And she rocked the whole building with slamming my door. And she's one of the people whom I respect the most out of that department. But it's just little things like that that, you know, you could have those kinds of arguments, intense, super arguments, and then you could be friends and it was all over.
So that is, in fact, a story about the collegiality of the
department. Absolutely. And she's still a friend. I mean, you can do those kinds of things. I mean, there are other stories like that, but that was one where she put me in my place in a very nice way, And then when it was all over, then we just stood there and laughed. I mean, that's all I could do is just laugh when she did it, because I had acted so infantile slamming her door, and then she demonstrated to me what really could be done. There are lots of stories like that. There have been some absolutely great people in that department, from the administrative assistant level, through chairs, through long-term faculty members. Howard Reinhardt, one of the past chairs and the former dean, is just one of my heroes, and he always has been. I'll tell one more story. When I was here the very first year, I was invited to go give a colloquium over at the University of Washington, Washington State University. And being very young and not knowing much about Montana, my wife, son, and I loaded into a Volkswagen and drove from here to Pullman in the middle of winter in a snowstorm, which was incredibly stupid. But we didn't know any better. We'd moved out here from the South. And we got there. I did this colloquium at Washington State University, which was a disaster. I mean, it was one of the first talks that I'd ever given. I was very young, very nervous, and did a lousy job. I mean, that's the only way to put it. Okay. Luckily, I had to go the next day and give one at Eastern Washington. So we had to follow a snowplow from Pullman to Spokane. But I had to give the second talk there. I think if I hadn't had to give that second talk, I just would have hidden away and never come back to this campus. But I came back and I talked to Howard Reinhardt about it. And he gave me much encouragement as a young faculty member to put that in its perspective. Okay, yes, you probably had a lousy experience. What can you learn from it, and where can you go from there? And that kind of sums up in my mind a lot of what was going on in that department. There are people who are willing to help young faculty members. And he gave me a tremendous amount of help right there. In that one day, I have tried to tell him that over the years, but here's somebody who was seasoned, a well-known faculty member, active in campus and all facets of this campus throughout all of his career, taking the time to work with me and help me when I needed it. I don't know any other way to put that. That's another example of the type of collegiality. That's a little better than the door slamming incident, but very, very helpful. And that's where I found the department to be throughout most of the years. Good place. Good doctoral programs. Good graduate programs in general. So,
but you've retired, and now you're finally leaving. Well, this year.
I will tell you one other thing that I did. I mean, I left the department because of being president of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. The retirement system never going to encourage me because of the salaries and the way salaries are done when you retire, that I basically had to retire. Okay, for my own financial benefit later. And Provost Muir asked me to apply for the job as director of the Center for Teaching Excellence. And I took this job, and it turned out to be a pretty great job. Very different from anything I had ever done, because as the director of the Center for Teaching Excellence, I got to work with faculty all over campus. And the office had spent a year with nobody in it. Mark Krakalici, who is chair of chemistry now, had been in the office part-time. He got a reduced load or something from one class to run this office, and then he had become chair of the department and stopped doing this one. And so it had a year where nobody was in the office. And then I got to working in here, and it gave me an opportunity that turned out to be one that I really like, because one of the things, and I can just give you an example right now, that we're doing in January is we're setting up one of the first faculty development workshops. It'll be a day-long series of workshops where we didn't know whether or not faculty would come. It's on January 16th. It's the day before spring semester starts, and we've had almost 80 people sign up. And I think it had never been done before. So there is opportunity. This faculty still wants to keep learning. They want to know more about teaching. And so that puts me back in line with the way I started. Mm-hmm. I started as a teacher, and I guess I'll wind up being a teacher until I end. And then I was asked to go to Ole Miss to help them develop a center like this one. Mm-hmm. So that's the next phase. Mm-hmm. And it's with many regrets that I'm leaving here. But I am going down there for family reasons and because there's a challenge in that job.
Good.
So,
but you also told me before we started taping that you are going to keep your house in Missoula.
Yes.
What's the pull?
We own an old house down on 5th Street, mm-hmm. which some of the early faculty members lived in, mm-hmm. we were told. We renovated it. It was a dump when we bought it. And that's the only way to describe it. Mm-hmm. And we have the pictures to prove it. It was falling down, and we decided that it was a house that needed saving. And it's over 100 years old, and it's one of the early houses on this side of the river, mm-hmm. in Missoula. And we like the people here. We've certainly loved the house, but the house would just be a house without the people around. And one of my next-door neighbors is Merle Manus, a former faculty member in mathematics, and he takes care of us. He has since he retired. And we hope he'll continue to, because it's a great neighborhood. And we're down in an area where there's a mix of apartments, condos, private homes, and the whole bit. Mm-hmm. It's an area of town that we like. We sometimes get serenaded when the bars close and people are walking back to the dorms. But it's a lively part of town. And this is a good place to live. It was a good place to have a kid grow up. And it certainly will keep us here, I think, for the future.
Good. Well, good luck at Ole Miss. Hopefully see you back in Missoula.
Thank you.
All right.